Good morning, and you're very welcome to the program. Between now and nine, the chances of a repeat performance of last winter's weather, tailoring the perfect cut of nature restoration just for you, and lessons in how to do a national park from the woman who runs Yosemite. Good morning, everybody. If it is good with you where you are right now, get out there and make the most of it, because there is, unfortunately, heavy rain and strong winds hitting the south this morning, moving across the country, which is a very unfortunate backdrop, but appropriate nonetheless, for what it is that we're going to talk about first this morning. When all of that unending rain of winter and spring finally eased off, there were things that were said and there were things that were unsaid. Of course, everybody said out loud, thank God. What was unspoken was the nagging question, is this how it's going to be from now on? Well, this morning we have an answer to that question. Scientists at World Weather Attribution have just completed a study into what role climate change did or didn't play in the unusually large number of storms between last autumn and this spring, and how that did or didn't influence the amount of rain that fell on Ireland and Britain, and most importantly, what are the chances that it's all going to happen again? The results, which one scientist described to me as game-changing for this part of the world, were shared with the media on Tuesday.
So today you'll be hearing from four authors of the study. We've got Sarah Q from the Royal Netherlands Meteorological Institute, or KNMI. We've got Kira Ryan from MetEireann, Mark McCarthy from the Met Office.
Scientists from universities and meteorological services around Western Europe conducted the study because last year was so unusually stormy and wet.
The main goal of WWA is to answer the question of the role of climate change in an extreme weather event immediately following the event.
Named storms got as high as the letter K for Kathleen, which has only happened once before. And this was the third wettest winter in Ireland since national records began.
In addition, the agricultural sectors also suffered, with storms causing crop losses and financial strains on farmers, which had knock-on consequences on food supply and food prices.
They looked at how much more likely all this wet weather was made by climate change, but of much more use to anybody trying to farm. They gave the likelihood of what has just happened happening again.
A season as stormy as 23-24 is estimated to have a return period of about 1 in 4 years. And for rainfall on stormy days, 1 in 5 years. The precipitation for the season overall was estimated at around a 1 in 20 year return period for current climate.
Turning all of that maths into English, what he's saying is that there's a 1 in 4 chance of future years being as stormy as last year. There is a 1 in 5 chance that those storms will bring as much rain as they did last year. And there is a 5% chance that the 6 months from October to March will be as wet as last year, between storms and more normal rainfall.
We've had, you know, persistent rainfall going back to July, so there's really been no respite.
Dr. Kira Ryan, a climatologist at MetEireann, was the senior Irish researcher on this study.
So when we looked at rainfall associated with storms, we found that in a 1.2 degree cooler world, so pre-industrial climate, we'd expect that type of an event to occur about once every 50 years. And now in our current climate, with the human-induced warming, we expect it to occur about once every 5 years. So that's an increase, making it 10 times more likely, like an increase by a factor of 10 in today's current climate.
This year just gone, one of the wettest and stormiest ever, has, you are saying, a 20% chance of happening every year from now on.
That's correct. There are other factors with storms, of course, that you need to consider. But certainly there's a large increase in the likelihood of how often we would expect to get a similar season.
That's all pretty sobering. But you're saying that these odds are correct at this temperature that we're at now. Presumably then, as it gets warmer, the odds of repeat performances of the winter spring that we have just seen will increase.
Yes, that's right. So we did look at that as well. The rainfall associated with storms, we found that that would increase further. The intensity would have a further 4% increase, and we would also expect the likelihood to change, so to change to about a 1 in 3 year event.
1 in 3, a 33% chance, you're saying, that by 2045, 2050, when we reach 2 degrees, that those would be the odds on having a winter as wet as the one we've just had.
Yes, and that's what the models project, the probability of it happening in any given year in our current climate. And of course, these aren't fixed values either. We do need to consider that as the climate change, these values change with them, likely increasing further.
Were all of these results in line with what you and your colleagues expected to find, Ciara, or were you surprised by any of them?
They're not shocking. Well, they are shocking, but not, I suppose, unexpected. You know, what we're seeing is concrete evidence showing us that climate change is influencing the likelihood and intensity of these rainfall events.
Is the bottom line here, Ciara, that it is just going to get an awful lot wetter, and that in 10 years' time, the winter that we have just had might not seem that unusual or out of place?
Yeah, I suppose the projections, you know, even in Metairn, we have the Translate projections, and they're showing us that annual rainfall is expected to increase. And as warming increases, we see bigger changes in winter rainfall as well, with winters getting wetter. It's likely these trends will continue. So we need to incorporate that into future planning.
Dr. Ciara Ryan and Met Aaron. So how do we plan for this now? Because there's all kinds of profound changes that are going to flow from this. But the people at the sharpest point of all of this are those trying to produce food for the rest of us. So what I've done this morning is I've invited back some of the growers and the farmers that we were already talking to on the programme during that wettest of winters to get their reaction to this news. Paul Brophy, first up, is a broccoli producer who you might remember wasn't able to get his heavy planting machinery out into the fields when I visited him a month or two back in Kildare. He joins me in studio. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
What was your reaction when you heard this report?
I wasn't really surprised because we were at the coal face of it, and I could see the impact of it every day. You know, we were attempting to do some work, and it didn't surprise me, but it's shocking that it's probably going to get worse. And, you know, the new norm will be what we had, which we were barely able to cope with. And one of the things that wasn't mentioned in this report was with the rain comes lack of frost. And frost was nature's way of dealing with things like pests and that over and killing off the disease spores that are knocking around. And we saw no frost practically in December and January.
And one of the other things that wasn't mentioned, because this was a study about rainfall and storms, is that you might just be a couple of days away from needing to irrigate.
Absolutely. It's crazy when you think about it. We have crops that were put into very wet soils back in April, should have been March, and they've shallow rooted. So a lot of the roots are in the top sort of 12 or 15 centimetres of the soil, and they're not going to cope with if it dries out now. So yeah, we wouldn't be far away.
You have already done quite a clever bit of climate proofing, as it were. You have farms all over Leinster as a sort of a hedge against heavy rain happening in one place but not in another. Is that the kind of thing that everybody's going to have to do now?
Well, it depends. I suppose it won't suit everybody's business model. I mean, when you have a spread out activity like that, there's a lot more management in it. So somebody that's smaller or niche, you know, they won't have the equipment to travel, or it just wouldn't work for them.
But the prudence of doing that was something that was brought home to you just once again this week.
Yeah, that's correct. On Tuesday, the rainfall on our farm was about 4.85 mils in a thigh.
A light dusting in a thigh,
in a thigh, nothing at all. And then you go up to Grange Conn and 48 mils in an afternoon. And, you know,
okay. And when you have 48 mils, how many days is it before you get back into that field again?
It'd be probably a week.
Okay. People like you are caught between sort of a rock and a hard place of rising costs in this now shorter growing season. Remind me, how many people were there who were doing what you do just 6 years ago?
In broccoli production, there was 18 in 2018, and we have six today. And that's driven purely by the hardships caused by weather, economic return, and probably the ageing profile of the growers.
Okay. And the expectation that we all continue to pay the same amount of money for our head of broccoli.
Well, that is going to come to an end, believe me.
Right, we'll come back to that issue in a moment, but let me bring in Donal Kavanagh, who's a dairy farmer on the Wicklow-Carlow border who was putting his cows out for just a few hours at a time when I visited him a couple of weeks ago. Donal, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Philip. How are you doing?
Remind us, how much of your farm ended up out of bounds, effectively, over this winter and spring?
I'd say about over 20%. Couldn't access because of it's just too wet. We just had to forget about it.
Okay, that meant not spreading any slurry on it. That meant not taking any silage from it. That meant not putting any cows out to graze on any of it.
Exactly. Yeah. We couldn't access it, and we couldn't graze it or take a first cut off it.
So while your cows were all inside for most of the day, you did some calculations on how much extra that was costing you a month.
Yeah, at the time it was costing about 3,500 a month because of the wet weather and extra days lost to grazing. That was the sort of cost that was involved. Okay. In extra feed, extra labour, extra work because of the wet weather.
You're in a slightly better position than many people, though, Donal, because after the drought of 2018, you destocked. By how much?
I pulled back stocking rates by about 20%, purely because, I just feel myself in the last 78 years that these weather extremes are just harder to farm. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking in the situation maybe because, at the stage where I'm at, I don't want to stay running at that pace anymore, and I want to find a sweet spot. So I don't want to get once you hit them extremes and a high stocking rate, it can get very costly. So
if you hadn't done that, Donal, would you be reducing your herd now in response to this?
I'm not so sure. Everybody is a bit different, I made them choices, depending on the level of debt you're at and how fast you have to run, basically. You don't have a choice sometimes. You just have to keep going. I made the choice because for lifestyle reasons and different things that it's not where I wanted to stay going. It was just them extremes was just too hard to cover every time. So I wanted to go into a place where it was easier managed.
There's an obvious financial toll to all of this. Talk to me, though, about the mental and the emotional toll on you of just waking up day after day, morning after morning, and thinking, oh, God, here's another day of the same thing.
Yeah, no, it would be. It's very frustrating. You're hoping to get the grass. I mean, obviously, grass is your cheapest input. And when you can't get to that, there's a cost every day. So the days you can't get out, there's more labour, there's more bedding cubicles, there's more diesel, oil, labour, everything involved. So for that reason, it's costly. It costs all the time in the system there.
And costs mentally, emotionally as well. Look, I don't want people to think that we're being total catastrophists here, because, of course, farmers have always been adapting and have always found workarounds. Is this just another thing to work around?
It is. It's just an added, I suppose, in the sense that it's something that we didn't really maybe have as extremes before, but it's something that's definitely has played into the system in the last couple of years, and it's something that we have to deal with. But farmers do adapt, and that's what they've always done. And weather related over the years, if you got bad weather, you had to adapt and you had to keep moving. You had no choice.
Maria Flynn is a potato farmer in Louth who has been on Countrywide in the past talking about her heritage potatoes. Maria, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, everybody. How are you?
How much land did you lose to rain this winter?
With our potatoes, we were unable to harvest 8 acres, which on the scale that we grow at is massive, you know.
So was that your profit margin for the year?
And more.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Your last handful of acres are generally your profit. And whether you're a big farm or a small one like us, that's the rule. The last few acres that you harvest is your profit. So I would say it actually created a debt situation, not just a non-profit situation, you know.
How many years on the trot can you do something like that before you have to close the gate permanently?
Well, I think I've been listening there, and both farmers have said, you know, it's individual. So I can only speak on behalf of myself and my husband, David, who is the potato farmer. We have been affected by this in maybe smaller ways, but certainly been affected by this year on year for at least 7 years. We're here to speak about one specific report, but it's to do with weather, and the rain problem has been slowly creeping up on us for a while. Now, there have been drought problems thrown in between, but it's predominantly been a rain problem that's been building up on us for the last few years and making things progressively more difficult. Maybe hasn't hit the bigger growers as much in the last few years, but I'm sure they've all noticed it, recognised it, but they've been able to react to it better than we have in terms of better machinery, etc. But I think what this last year has shown is this is here. It's going to affect every farmer, regardless of the bank balance, the amount of acres, the machinery they have. I don't know. We definitely. Why would you want to? We love farming. Like every farmer that does farm, they do it for love, and that's 100% true. But there comes to a point when, you know, your mental health, your family, everything has to come first. Mm, mm. So I don't know what the answer is. I'm suppose like the other two farmers there, my thoughts, I spend a lot of time in my head at the moment, not so much about myself and David, but the next generation. And my questions, and I have been asking questions with Chagask, is these young farmers that are currently in college, or probably more specifically the guys and girls that are going to be going to agricultural colleges in the next few years, are they still being taught the same version of what my husband was taught when he went to college on how to grow your crops?
Or are they being taught how to farm in this changed world?
Or are they being taught how to deal with this? Because we can, there's a lot of talk around, say, for tillage farmers, growing a different kind of crop than what we've been used to. And that's innovation, and that's pushing forward, and that's solving the problems. Mm-hmm.
Well, are there workarounds for you, Maria? Because look, and feed his cows indoors. Paul can buy more land dotted around the country to avoid the rain. Can you adapt when your potatoes are in the ground with all that rain coming down?
We can adapt to the crops that maybe will grow better in those different weather climates. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, a machine still has to go into a field and harvest, and that's where the problem is going to be, you know. So I don't know what technology is coming up in machinery, but I know that we won't be investing in it. I wonder,
because that would just be throwing good money after bad.
Well, it'll be you know, we made a decision a few years ago. We were at a decision a few years ago, not so much to do with weather, but just to do with price points and the value of what we were growing being constantly decimated. Okay. We either had to make a decision to get bigger or stop. Now, we fell into a niche market. Well, we didn't fall in. We created a niche market with our potatoes that is pulling us through, and we love doing it. But we're now in a situation where what do you do about not being able to get a machine into a field? I don't know what to do about that.
Well, we keep on seeming to come around or come back to this issue of price, which I'm going to deal with properly before we finish this discussion. But I want to move on to the tillage sector and to John Murphy, who's both a tillage and dairy farmer near Enniscorthy. John, how much land went unharvested last year on your farm because it was just too wet to send any machinery into the fields?
Good morning, Philip, and good morning to the listeners. I suppose what I ended up on harvesting last year was probably in around 30% of my farm. We just, in Wexford especially last year, we got a lot of rain at the very wrong time. Where I suppose across Wexford, in the same year, there was about 2,500 acres not harvested, which was kind of a frightening figure when we seen the like of other counties and they did get it harvested. But it was all down to just rain at the wrong time.
But John, 30% of your farm unharvested, and now this report says a 20% likelihood of the same volume of rain again next year. What's your reaction to that?
Well, it'd make you think very strongly about sowing crops again into that particular land that you didn't harvest. But I've just seen, I suppose, in the last, since 2018, we've had no year the same either. Like we in 2022, we had what you'd call the perfect year. Mm. And we need to think, I know the report the same 1 in 4 could be a problem, but we need to try and mitigate against that as best we can. But like, it's not a case that we can stop either. I can't see how I can just stop sowing grain and start doing something else. I don't know how.
Talk to me about what that does to you, knowing that you have to keep on going, that you really don't have a choice, but seeing this ever-decreasing likelihood that you're ever going to get 2 or 3 successive good years in a row again.
Well, it is. It's a hard thing to do. Like, I've still crops to sow at the minute, which is probably a month late. But, like, I suppose if there weren't so much maybe criticism of what farmers do, and maybe if powers that be would listen to farmers a little bit more, it wouldn't be as hard to do the work that we've to do, along with all the regulation that's thrown on top of us as well.
It's not welcome news, this report, obviously, but is it helpful that it provides perhaps a little bit of clarity?
Well, I suppose knowledge is worth a lot. Like, once if you can know, I'm not saying, like, it's not going to be definitely correct, everything that's in the report, but it's knowledge to have that you could sow different crops, that you could maybe sow crops in different fields, try get drier lands. But I just seen the driest of farms last year here in Wexford, and they didn't harvest the crops. It wasn't that we couldn't get the common into them. We just didn't get the weather in August. Yeah.
I gather you have a holy communion in your household this morning. When you look at them and you look to the next generation, do you see them doing the same thing as you on the same land?
I would like to think that they would, but there's probably more days that you'd be saying, Jesus, I wish to go find a handier job or something easier to do. But like Maria said earlier on, it's not, I think farming is kind of, if it's in you, it's in you. If it's not, you won't do it. But if the farming streak is in a person, they tend to keep on trying somehow or another.
Paul, let me come back to you into this issue of price that we've been kind of dancing around there. There was, in addition to this report, there was another report published this week by Thea Hennessy in UCC that showed 60% of shoppers want their food to be more sustainable, but only 30% were prepared to pay anything extra for that. Can you reconcile those two things?
No, not really, because it contradicts. Food has to be, I suppose, long-term. You look at the long-term effects of this, and if we develop a sort of a short-term policy of cheap today will be dear tomorrow. We have to invest in our businesses. We have to, I suppose, pivot and change our strategies.
Because for you, the key thing here is 18 broccoli growers in 2018 and only 6 now. You know, we're not too many years away on that track from there only being 1 or 2.
Or none, and it all imported, you know, because that's happened in other crops where people have exited completely out of it. And that's not good. It's not good for the consumer, because if that happens, then they will pay more for their product. So I think we have to look at a long-term strategy as well as a short-term.
If we want to keep food that is even vaguely affordable, we have to keep on producing it on this island and not importing, is what you're saying.
Absolutely, and educate the people about the consequences of it, that, you know, it's affordable food, not cheap food.
Okay. So the people who think that climate change isn't going to affect them and that they can weather a little bit of extra rain, a 20% chance of as much rainfall again next year, aren't taking into consideration that how climate change is going to affect them is the end of the era of cheap food, really.
There's no doubt about it. That will be the consequences of it, yeah.
Paul Brophy, thank you very much. Also to Donald Kavanagh, Maria Flynn and John Murphy. We'll be back after these.
Email countrywide at rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
While we were talking to so many people that we have heard from in the past on Countrywide, I've been reminded that unfortunately during the week there was another person, John Robinson in Kilkenny, who we had heard from on this programme during calving in the past, who was unfortunately buried on Thursday. A really, really lovely man, incredibly generous with his time and his advice. I gather it was a very, very big funeral in Kilkenny, just outside Callan. So thoughts with the Robinson family there. And it chimes with what we're going to talk about next. When it comes to finding out how to improve a farm's biodiversity, there is plenty of general advice that is doled out by the powers that be. But what if a farmer wants individual, specialised advice for just their farm? Well, The Horse's Mouth is a mentorship programme run by Farming for Nature, where one of their farmer ambassadors will visit your farm to have a one-to-one chat about how you'd like to shape it to help improve biodiversity. The scheme is in hot demand every year, with just 50 places on offer, and our reporter Hannah Quinn Mulligan travelled to Clare to meet farmer and mentor Mona Muller to find out what makes the mentorship scheme so special.
That bird song is amazing.
Yeah. Every morning I'm up with the bird song because I sleep just up there and I have my window wide open. I couldn't otherwise, I'd feel kind of locked in if I'd keep the window closed. Then the cuckoo is really strong first thing in the morning. Like late at night you get the song thrushes. And I had a barn owl circling this little field, it's just in front of my window there. A couple of nights now in a row. It's particularly when it gets a bit drier, the river is a bit quieter and you can really hear all your night birds and everything.
You're such a scenic location. Your house is just in front of us and we're in a field in front of your house. There's a river running by it that we can hear in the background. The ducks have come down to say hello. You're milking as well in a micro dairy just for your own family, and you have vegetables growing, you have other bits and bobs. I'm nearly scared to ask what else you have going on as well. You've some sucklers as well, don't you? And on top of this, then
beef rearing from the dairy cows, really.
And then on top of all of this, you decided to take on a mentorship role with Farming for Nature for their Horse's Mouth. So one farmer, you being the farmer, it gives another farmer advice on perhaps how they might want to manage their grasslands or put in something to help biodiversity in nature.
It's something you kind of naturally want to do, you know. You have something that you really value, which is this family farming. I mean, we came very much out of trying to be as self-sufficient as possible with everything, so we kind of do everything, you know, from eggs, meat, vegetables, milk, cheese, everything. It's a little bit mad sometimes, but it was very small at the start and it grew and grew and grew. And you can kind of see, you know, with this kind of farming, which is fairly low stocked and still gives a return. I mean, if I had to buy the food I'm producing, or we're producing altogether, we'd probably pay at least 300, 350 euros a week just on food. So that's an income as well. And you want to spread the news, you know, this kind of farming in this area where people generally just dump cattle somewhere to get the payments and then take the cattle off in the winter because the land is so bad that you can't...
It is a corner of County Clare that is unbelievably beautiful. It's outside Scariff area, we could say. And people just forget. And people abandon the land as well. It's so sad. But you are creating a thriving industry. And it's one of the busiest farms. There's so many young people walking around doing stuff as well.
We're fortunate that our children are many. I mean, we have four children and three of them are still here in some form or other. I mean, two of them are very heavily involved, including their partners. And one of them has renovated an old cottage that was on the farm. And I feel so blessed. I feel so blessed that I want to be here. And I feel so blessed that this is possible. I mean, nobody of us is getting rich or anything, but we have our own food and we have everything we need and everything we want. And it's such a blessing to be able to do this.
Mona clearly took to the mentoring like a duck to water. But I was interested to find out what her mentee, part-time beef farmer Keith Ranelow, also based in County Clare, had made of the whole experience.
Well,
We'll give Keith a call because we're standing in front of the pond, so we'll talk ponds next. One second. Give him a warning first.
Hello, Anna.
Hey, Keith, how are you? I'm here with Mona on her farm.
How are you?
Hey, Keith, how are you?
Very good, Mona.
Nice to hear you again. How are you getting on?
All good, good. Yeah, just here enjoying the sunshine today.
Keith, what was the experience like, inviting Mona onto your farm? Because sometimes farmers can feel a bit funny about inviting another farmer onto their land. They think they're going to be judged. How was it for you?
I found it brilliant. It was just sort of a very informal walk. I think we walked every inch of the land.
Yeah.
And just opened up my eyes. So it was very encouraging to Mona be pointing out stuff we're doing right. And then it was very encouraging then getting ideas off Mona where we can improve things and sort of, you know, tips of what we can do. So I found it brilliant. Another thing Mona pointed out then was owl boxes. So we're hoping to put up 2 owl boxes this year and hopefully we'll get some inhabitants in the near future.
Yeah, that's the one limiting factor for owls, is that they need enough places where they can nest, because the population of owls is looking very, very positive, funnily enough, because of that shrew that moved into the country. Yeah, they're keeping them in check and they're thriving on them. So yeah, we have owls here now as well on the farm, which I'm completely thrilled about. And we put owl boxes up there a couple of years ago, and one of them is occupied. So that's really rewarding. So yeah, put up them owl boxes. It's so nice to hear them screeching at night and hear the mating calls and that. Yeah, absolutely do.
Cheers, Keith. Take care.
Okay, brilliant, Anna. Thanks, Mona.
Bye, talk to you later.
Cheerio. Bye.
There you go, nothing but a positive review.
Glowing. he's a lovely man.
But you know, that what was nice was it was just a chat between farmers.
Yeah, that's it. And it was very informal and very kind of on one level. So it wasn't like I had to not lecture him or anything. Like I wouldn't want to anyway, but so it was just very positive. And you know, farms, that's what we love, and that's what you have in common. And you straight away have a friend. Because farming can be a very lonely occupation. You know, you're there on your farm and you're working away and you're fighting the nettles. It's really lovely if somebody points out, you know, there's a caterpillar that really needs nettles. Why not? And then you just straight away feel positive about your bit of neglect or whatever you thought you were doing. Yeah, and also, you know, rushes, like, you can't fight rushes. Like, it's an endless battle. Just make friends with them. You know, look at the little meadow pippin nests in them and just think, it's okay.
Mona Muller with our Hannah in Clare. And applications for that scheme are open until the 31st of May. You can find out more information on farmingfornature.ie. Farmingfornature.ie. The person I want to speak to next this morning has been cutting a dash across the country all week long. You may already have heard the superintendent of Yosemite National Park is here because we're twinning our own Wild Neffen Park with the granddaddy of all national parks in California. But this morning I want to move the conversation with her along in a direction that hasn't yet been covered. What is a national park? What is its job? Because we have two new ones that do very different things. We haven't yet properly defined what we mean in this country when we say national park. So, Cicely Muldoon, Superintendent of Yosemite National Park, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Philip. Thanks for having me.
You are about to head off up Croke Patrick, aren't you?
I hope so, yes.
Yes, well, you're right to hope so, because I think you've got rain on the way there by about midday. Do you think you can get up and down in that kind of time?
Well, I'll have to walk fast. We'll see what I can do.
Talk to me about national parks. Can you have one that does two things simultaneously, conserving biodiversity and also being a tourist attraction that provides an economic return? Or is there just too great a tension between those two things?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I'd say national parks not only do two things at once, they probably do 20 things at once. These are places that we set aside because they have something very special about them. And usually those special things are not only biodiversity and incredible habitat, but they also tell the stories of the land, people who have been on the land and who are in many cases on the land still. So parks really capture our history, both natural and cultural.
But we want them, on the one hand, to preserve and conserve wilderness and nature for us, but we also want them to serve as places that we can get an economic return for and that will draw people to Ireland and Ireland Inc. How have you reconciled those two different things in California?
Yeah, you know, parks are a massive draw for people from all over the world. Yosemite in particular, I can walk around the Yosemite Valley and not hear English spoken sometimes. It's such a draw for people all over the world. Yeah, it's a fine line to walk. Parks belong to everyone, and they're sort of a global resource, so it is wonderful, and it's good for the communities to bring people in and help the economy for sure. But you have to manage it carefully so that you don't damage those resources that the park was created to protect. It's a tension for sure, but it's manageable. Your work is never done in taking care of that. You have to pay a lot of attention to why the park was created and what you're trying to protect, and in many cases restore and improve, and make sure you don't draw so much human activity that you damage those things that the park was created to protect.
Yosemite is obviously enormous by comparison with any of our national parks. Is that task of conservation and accommodating tourists made easier by that size? I mean, particularly when you look at the size of our parks by comparison.
Yosemite is about 95% wilderness. Unless you're a strong hiker, much of the park is not very accessible. People are really concentrated in places like Yosemite Valley and the Mariposa Grove of giant sequoias. So it's similar to a smaller size park, and where the people go, where the facilities are, is a much smaller area, except for those that are quite adventurous and want to get out into the wilderness. So it's really quite comparable.
The other tension, of course, is that our national parks are, in many areas, living landscapes where people are drawing their livelihoods from the land. How do you reconcile those two things, or can you? Intensive farming or fishing and tourism and conservation?
Good question. It's complicated. It's absolutely complicated. But I think the strongest parks are those who are so embedded with the local community that the community are its greatest protectors. And you can do all those things. It's nuanced, of course. You have to always be thinking about why the park was created and what resources you're trying to protect, what the biodiversity complications are. But people have always been in the landscape. They've always been working on the land, and we are part of the land as well. So I think you can have those two things together.
You, of course, have indigenous communities within Yosemite, don't you? Living on tribal lands, Native American people. Do you think there's any comparison to be drawn between how you have accommodated those people within Yosemite and the communities that are living and working within our national parks?
I really do. We have a dark history with our Native American community, absolutely. But today in Yosemite, we have 7 different tribes who call Yosemite home, and we work with them, I would say, every day. We have a tribe working on bringing back a village to Yosemite Valley that they were eradicated from in the late 1960s. So we're really trying to turn the page on the past of how we dealt with indigenous communities and getting smart enough now, I should say, to learn from that traditional ecological knowledge. We work with tribes today to bring back cultural burning, for example, in Yosemite Valley, which the tribes have conducted there for forever, as they have really around the world. Bringing in burning to a landscape helps prevent the catastrophic wildfires we have seen that have come about as a result of climate change. So the knowledge that comes from those communities, those people who have always been on the land, is vast.
That is interesting, isn't it? Because it means then that not only is there this task of providing a living for people, conservation of nature, tourist attraction, but the other job of a national park is to conserve culture, to conserve history, and that impact that man of 100, 200 or 500 years ago has had on the landscape.
Yes, for sure. And this week we took a look at at a famine cabin that has been restored, and the last family who died in the famine is preserved there and remembered there. And you know, it's a local story, and the local community is proud and happy that that is preserved. But it's also a global story. It's the story of my family, really, who left Ireland generations ago because of that. So it's those small stories of people on the land that really resonate, internationally, I would say.
As we try and do this exercise of defining what it is that an Irish national park should be, there are some purists who say that there should be zero agricultural activity within a national park, that it should be exclusively about preserving nature. Is there, in your mind, an argument? Are there examples in the United States of a national park being the kind of place where you should be testing things like the high nature value farming that we just heard about in Hannah's report there, and fine-tuning those schemes within a national park so that you can roll them out nationally?
Yes, yeah, certainly. You know, Yosemite is an old place. We've set aside in 1864 by President Lincoln. So it's a park that doesn't have those kinds of things. But parks that were created more recently in the United States absolutely embed working landscapes into part of the reason the park was created, part of the stories that we are trying to preserve that tell the stories of the country, much like Ireland is doing. And there's a way to do it. I don't want to pretend that it's super easy, because of course it isn't, but bringing along the local community, engaging with humanity in the management of parks is always evolving. And having people on the landscape is one of those things that's becoming more common in national parks around the world. It builds support, because what we're really trying to do is save these places forever, is save these places for future generations. We can't do that without the people's support.
So obviously not in Yosemite, but are there other national parks, not just in the United States, but anywhere else that you've seen, that can encompass intensive agriculture or commercial forestry?
Yes. Even in Yosemite, it's not commercial forestry per se, but we do a lot of tree removal because of past human practices. We have we suppressed cutting down trees in the national parks about 120 years ago. It was seen as a bad practice. We suppressed all wildfires, I should say, and that has led to an unnatural condition with a high fuel loading, and helped contribute, along with droughts and climate change, to these catastrophic wildfires we've seen in the United States and really around the world. So I'm drifting away from your question, I think, Philip, but bringing back those practices of selective thinning of the trees and putting prescribed fire on the ground in Yosemite has resulted in a much healthier landscape.
So less likely to be devastated by a wildfire. No, I understand. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. You can't just put a fence around a park. You know, it's a living landscape in every regard, with all the creatures that inhabit it, I would say, including humanity.
Where are your people from the Muldoons? You have to be Irish or maybe Scottish.
Oh, Irish all the way. We have family from Tipperary and Limerick and Westmeath and Galway. And you've told me Kildare, so I believe you.
Well, yes, I was really rather rude about the number of Muldoons in Kildare when we were talking yesterday. So I apologise once again
like
for
weeds,
that.
Like weeds, I think you said.
Cicely Muldoon, Superintendent of Yosemite National Park, a very good morning to you, and thank you very much for talking to us on Countrywide today. This conversation was something of a curtain raiser for a special programme that we're going to be doing in 2 weeks' time, when we're going to be exploring all of this in our newest national park in County Kerry. That is it for this weekend. The Countrywide Park Rangers were Amandine Paso Devine, keeping an eye out for Ranger Smith, James Feeney snatching the picnic baskets, and Brenda Donoghue was always a much smarter bear than the average bear. Good morning, have a good weekend.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.